From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump will leave his historic summit with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un earlier than planned because things are moving more quickly than expected. This according to a White House statement released today. The talks, the first ever between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader, are scheduled for 9 o'clock tonight, East Coast time. NPR's Anthony Kuhn is in Singapore. And Anthony, you tell us that aides to both Trump and Kim Jong-un have been working feverishly setting the stage for the talk. So are they genuinely saying, you know, one day is all the time they need, or is something else happening?
Yes, well, it's really hard to say why this is happening. What Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said today is that he's very optimistic and that tomorrow President Trump and Chairman Kim will meet one-on-one. The only other people in the room will be translators. Then they'll branch out into bigger bilateral talks. But in the morning, it'll just be them. So we don't know if this is because they've already sealed a deal in advance and they're just putting on a show for the good optics, or if we have two genuine high-stakes, high-rolling risk-takers who are going to go head-to-head to try to nail out a deal with not much script. And we've had mixed messages. At times, the U.S. has said the talks are going to be flexible, they're going to be spontaneous. President Trump has also said he will know in his gut in a matter of minutes if it's going to go well and a deal can be reached or not. But today, Pompeo said that this could be just the start of much longer negotiations.
Well, Pompeo both spoke to reporters and released a statement saying that North Korea had previously confirmed its willingness to denuclearize. We're eager to see if these words prove sincere. But he also seemed to be talking about how this would set the stage for future talks. So when you say deal, certainly North Korea isn't expected to say they will denuclearize, and the U.S. isn't expected to say they'll pull U.S. troops out of the demilitarized zone, which is something that North Korea wants. What do you mean by deal?
Well, deal would be North Korea would denuclearize, would give up its nukes completely, verifiably, and irreversibly as the U.S. wants. And North Korea is demanding some sort of security guarantee from the U.S. We don't know exactly what that entails. But there are a couple of things that are noteworthy about, you know, Pompeo's remarks. One is when he says this sets the stage for future negotiations, the Trump administration seems to feel that previous U.S. administrations have gotten bogged down in months or years of talks and essentially got played. But now he's saying that this is not going to be so quick, that you know, talks are going to go on for a while. Also, Pompeo said today that the U.S. is eager to see if North Korea is serious about denuclearization. Now, Kim Jong-un has already stated to the leaders of South Korea and of China that he is serious about denuclearization, and yet the U.S. is still unsure.
But do you really think that there might be something that comes out of, you know, this initial summit that is a deal that has denuclearization and security in it?
Both sides have shown signs of flexibility. The North Korean side has shown flexibility in that it may be willing to give a little on its demand that the U.S. reduce its troop presence on the Korean Peninsula in South Korea. And the U.S. has indicated flexibility on things like, for example, a timeline for giving up the nukes, and also on some sort of security guarantee. While they haven't said what it will be, Pompeo said today very clearly that the U.S. is willing to make it worth North Korea's time to go into these talks, basically saying if they comply with our demands, they will be richly rewarded. Life will improve for the North Korean people.
And just, you know this region inside out. We're getting reports that North Koreans are getting their first news that Kim Jong-un is meeting with the U.S. President Trump. It's the front page of the ruling party's newspaper. It was the only item on the first news broadcast of the day on Korean Central TV. What is this doing for him back in his home country?
Clearly, it's preparing people psychologically for some possible changes. It's definitely significant that they are telling people in advance that this meeting is going to happen. Usually, diplomacy is conducted by North Korean leaders in secret. What North Korean media have been telling their own people is that North Korea has now completed a nuclear deterrent. And once it has that, it can now shift its attention to developing the economy and raising people's living standards. And of course, that's going to be welcome. At the same time, they've been talking about a shift in geopolitics. However, they also add that North Korea is going to remain independent. That could mean closer ties with the U.S., perhaps more distant ties with China, a sort of recalibration of the balancing act North Korea has to do with the big powers.
No. Of course, they're telling their people that they have created a nuclear deterrent so it can move on to the economy. But what if they have to give up that nuclear deterrent to move on to the economy? Fascinating. NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Singapore. Anthony, thank you so much for your expertise there.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, on his way to Singapore, President Trump lashed out at Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau following a tense G7 summit in Quebec, and members of Trump's administration piled on. Here's trade advisor Peter Navarro on Fox News Sunday responding to a press conference Trudeau held after the president left Canada.
There's a special place in hell for any foreign leader that engages in bad faith diplomacy with President Donald J. Trump and then tries to stab him in the back on the way out the door. And that's what bad faith Justin Trudeau did with that stunt press conference. That's what weak, dishonest Justin Trudeau did.
Trump reversed the U.S. endorsement of the G7 economic agreement after he left the summit en route to Singapore. Evan Dyer is senior reporter for the CBC. He joins us from Ottawa, Canada. Evan, welcome back.
Thanks.
And how are Canadians reacting to these personal attacks on Trudeau from the Trump administration?
Well, I think we would have to say that they weren't just on Trudeau, for one thing. Donald Trump, in his news conference before he left the G7, accused Canada of robbing the United States, and that was a comment directed at Canadians generally. So people are insulted. They're offended. There's been a bit of a kind of a rally round Trudeau effect caused by this. We've seen people like Doug Ford, you know, who was just elected as Premier of Ontario,
right,
and who's been described as a kind of a Trump-like politician, the brother of the famous crack-smoking mayor of Toronto, now deceased. Well, he's been tweeting, "I stand shoulder to shoulder with the Prime Minister." So right now, I would say the reaction is one of people being offended, and also it's made it much more difficult, I think, for the Trudeau government to make the kind of concessions that Donald Trump is looking for, because it will now look like a capitulation.
And what about the idea that Trudeau was stabbing Trump in the back on his way out of town by waiting for him to leave, get on Air Force One on the way to Singapore, and then holding this press conference and saying what he said?
Well, I think it seemed quite the other way around here. First of all, Trudeau's news conference was always scheduled for that time. It's Donald Trump who left the summit early, and it's Donald Trump who sent those tweets after leaving Canada. So I think we were speaking on Friday, you remember, Jeremy, and I said we have to wait to see what he says when he's out of the country, because in Mexico, of course, he didn't mention the wall. He waited till he was out of the country and then held a rally in Phoenix and said some very insulting things about Mexico. So there's a bit of a pattern there. But it must be said that unlike Mexico, he was also quite offensive while he was in Canada. The perception here, I think, generally is that Donald Trump was a guest in the country. He came up, threw a hissy fit, kicked over the furniture, insulted everybody, and then left early and left a very negative impression. And I think it's caused lasting damage to U.S.-Canadian relations.
Let's listen to what Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, said that apparently set Trump off. This is when he was talking about Canada applying equivalent tariffs to the ones that the U.S. is imposing on Canada.
I have made it very clear to the president that it is not something we relish doing, but it is something that we absolutely will do, because Canadians, we're polite, we're reasonable, but we also will not be pushed around.
Now, I haven't seen Trudeau say anything publicly since these personal attacks from President Trump. Has he?
No, he's actually taking a personal day today after the summit, and he had his foreign minister instead come out, Chrystia Freeland, and she said Canada's going to speak with deeds, not words. We're not interested in an ad hominem exchange, and Canada will proceed with its retaliatory tariffs on July 1st, which are dollar-for-dollar tariffs. But I must say that those remarks that Justin Trudeau made did not come as a surprise to the White House. He said them before. He said them on national television in the United States on Meet the Press.
Right.
He said them repeatedly in speeches. There's nothing that Justin Trudeau said in his closing news conference he hasn't said before. It's just that they waited until now to choose to get offended by it.
Okay, I want to just read you one more tweet. This comes from Roland Paris, who's a former foreign policy advisor to Trudeau. He tweeted this over the weekend about Trump. Big tough guy, once he's back on his airplane, can't do it in person and knows it, which makes him feel weak. So he projects these feelings onto Trudeau and then lashes out at him. You don't need to be Freud. He's a pathetic little man-child. Is that the former foreign policy advisor speaking for Trudeau, or do you think he's speaking on his own?
No, he may be channeling Trudeau's private thoughts, but that's certainly not the position the government of Canada is taking. Now, the government of Canada doesn't want to get into a Twitter war with Donald Trump. We've seen that he immediately escalates everything to the nth degree, and so that's not something that the government of Canada wants to do. The government of Canada, at the same time, isn't going to back down on its tariffs, and it's made that very clear. But Roland Paris, while he may be speaking for a lot of people, he's not speaking for the government of Canada.
It's Evan Dyer, a senior reporter with the CBC, joining us from Ottawa. Evan, thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Last night, the quiet little Broadway musical, The Band's Visit, won big at the Tony Awards, taking 10, including Best Musical, Best Original Score for David Yazbek, Best Actor and Actress in a Leading Role in a Musical for Tony Shalhoub and Katrina Lenk, Best Supporting Actor for Ariel Stachel, who spoke of his parents in the audience, his father, an Israeli-born Yemeni.
I have avoided so many events with them because for so many years of my life, I pretended that I was not a Middle Eastern person. And after 9/11, it was very, very difficult for me. And so I concealed, and I missed so many special events with them.
Stachel went on to applaud the musical for giving him and others in the cast a chance to embrace their Middle Eastern background. The Band's Visit is about an Egyptian police band that arrives accidentally in the dusty Israeli desert town of Petah Tikva with a B, instead of the vibrant cultural center of Petah Tikva with a P, as Katrina Lenk's cafe owner explains to bandleader Tony Shalhoub.
Where you are, this is not Petah Tikva. Such a city, nobody knows it. Not a fun, not a art, not a culture. This is Petah Tikva with a B.
Last January, we sat down with Katrina Lenk, director David Cromer, and Tony Shalhoub, and started by asking him what this show is really about.
Well, that's such a gigantic question. I think at its heart, it's about hope. And another layer under that is it's about people's ability to forgive either themselves or each other as a first step.
There's a fight that ensues. You're in the middle of a fight between Katrina's character, Dina, and a lover of hers. A very quiet, dignified character that you play, but he just bursts out, "You can forgive."
Yeah, and I think it's a deep lesson that he came to in his own life and didn't take the opportunity or didn't have the understanding to forgive, and that ended very badly. He's learned that if we all could do that, we can sort of salvage our broken lives.
Well, but of course it becomes at a time when there's a much bigger picture. You have Arabs and Israelis together in a town, and some would say, well, forgiveness, that's too simple. Katrina, your thoughts on that, because the characters don't talk about politics ever.
Yeah, it's not about politics. It's about people just being people and having basic human needs, love, food, joy.
Music.
Yeah. And music is a big connecting tool, I think, when you don't speak the same language.
But it's interesting that you say the music, because David, you as the director work around both the music and the book. Mm-hmm. Never has it been more clear that people could connect through the music and then had a hard time connecting when they didn't have the music.
It's a pretty obvious way for people to talk. Now, when we talk about the politics, the thing that I always think is interesting is there's a moment anytime you confront someone who is an other to you. We might feel tension, we might be mad, but I don't immediately start saying, in 1967, you know what I mean? We don't really do that. So when these characters, very ordinary people in a situation, are confronted with each other, there's a little switch in everyone's head, which is I can either freeze up or just say, we don't serve your kind around here or something, or we just say, oh, well, yeah, well, you can sit here, you can stay here for a little while. What do people talk about? We talk about food and music.
Love sparks on the upbeat, igniting with a minor nine, resolving to a minute.
major six, then something clicks and everything starts.
We're just saying it's just a way to fill the silence.
It is that very wide door that opens and everybody begins to flow in both directions.
We went to Israel. So many times as actors, you do all kinds of research and read things and imagine, and we didn't have to imagine anymore what it was like to be in this town. We could go and stand there on that sand and feel the wind, and just to get a sense of a place is, what a gift, what a gift. The similarities between all kinds of small towns and all kinds of people who feel stuck or people who are lost really was instantly relatable, and I think is relatable to a lot of people who come to see the show.
Tony, you do have Lebanese background, both your parents from Lebanon?
Well, my father was from Lebanon. My mother was born here, but her parents were from Lebanon. But I agree that it isn't really just about the Middle East. I got a letter recently from someone, they live in Ireland, about how they related to conflicts there, within their country, in small towns, and how people were hesitant to move into certain other areas, and how beautiful this was to them, and how relatable it was. My parents spoke Arabic, and my grandparents did. My grandfather, when he was a boy, he sang in the choir in Lebanon, in the church, whatever. We would go to visit them. They live near us. And he would be singing these songs in Arabic. Some were hymns, some were not. And it was beautiful and haunting and completely, for us, I grew up in Green Bay, for God's sake. And Yazbek music really evokes all of that.
And your hands just did what your character does as a conductor. You just were moving your hand. No, it was beautiful.
They also taught me to speak with my hands.
Well, it would mean a lot to me if, you know, just that notion of being able to sort of get in touch with your ancestors a little through this character.
Absolutely. And there's so much of this character of Tufik that seems like facets of my own father and my grandfather. He seems like an amalgam of all of these Arab men.
Very, very dignified, very straight-backed, very, in the case of this conductor that you play,
very,
yeah.
Very not forthcoming, frankly, or with a sort of a reluctance or an inability to express and verbalize, you know, all of these deep feelings and emotions. I don't gravitate to the musicals, usually. I had to overcome my fear. It was an experience of going way outside my comfort zone, and I'm so glad I did it. To be frank, I'm still nervous every night when I have to sing a cappella.
He has to do one of the hardest things ever at any point, even for anyone who does music theater all the time, which is get a note out of the ether and sing a cappella with no support whatsoever and end on the perfect note. It's like, it's an impossible task for anyone.
Beautiful. In fact, Katrina's character asks, is it a prayer or is it a hymn?
The tune seems sad, but are the words sad? What's he saying? Is he praying? And why does it get to me? Is he lonely? Maybe reaching out.
Katrina Lenk singing one of the showstoppers in the new Broadway hit, The Band's Visit. She has another one, The Breathtaking Omar Sharif, in which this Jewish cafe owner sings about her childhood idols, the Egyptian superstars, actor Omar Sharif, and singer and actress Umm Kulthum.
Sunday morning, Umm Kulthum, her voice would fill our lips.
Had you heard Umm Kulthum?
No, I knew who Omar Sharif was. Similarly, would watch movies with my mom of Omar Sharif. You know, Dr. Zhivago was, he was very dreamy. How did I not know who Umm Kulthum was? Now I'm like, what? How did I miss this phenomenon? Aretha Franklin, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, and Ella Fitzgerald, and Judy Garland all smooshed into one person. And how much meaning she had to the people in that area.
I would imagine you're now sending the audience out every night going to research Umm Kulthum. I mean, most Americans don't know. But that song, I mean, the range of it, the kind of way you have to sing it is almost a speaking. How would you talk about how you approach the song?
A lot of that is just because the song is so soulfully and intelligently written. It starts out small and then kind of gets carried away with itself.
And the music flows.
it's also great that, David, you the director, you see on stage people who talk about having a hard time getting cast in Hollywood because they are Middle Eastern and they're the bad guys usually, or the terrorists. And here they are, many of them actual professional musicians, on stage on Broadway.
Osama Farouk, who's our percussionist, who's brilliant, the most dazzling performance in the show, George Aboud. George Aboud is the fiddler, and there's been a lot of talk about young people. We had one at a talk back the other night who really said, it never occurred to me I would hear that kind of music in a show, that I would see people from my culture just being nice people in a story who are looking for a friend or looking for love or looking to get out of the hole they're in. It's an honor, and it's kind of scary. You know, you think about that when we first start being able to see stories about gay people or anything, where, like, any representation where you're anyone who's treated as the other in a culture, it's, I don't want to say it's important, but it's necessary.
Tony, just your thoughts on how the show's being embraced.
Well, there's definitely, I mean, first of all, just so gratifying to play to full houses. And there's a sort of a quietness, a stillness that we sense from the audience, which is very unlike a Broadway musical audience. At the end, where out of this silence comes this explosion of in their response.
I have heard in the from people afterwards, people that live in Israel or are Jewish or have Hebrew culture in their families, that they're like, oh my God, I'm so glad there's a story about us now, especially because of all the political stuff that's happening even here in the States.
On one stage, there's some hope.
This piece feels like, and people have mentioned this to us, that it is just a respite from all of the noise and nonsense that's occurring out there right now. They feel transported to this little desert town, and they kind of don't want to leave it.
Actors Tony Shalhoub and Katrina Lenk, along with director David Cromer, all of whom won Tonys last night. The Band's Visit won a total of 10. Get tickets. It's Here and Now.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
There's been an executive shakeup at Brightline, the private high-speed rail company in South Florida that just recently started service from Miami to West Palm Beach. The company named a new chief financial officer last week after other recent changes. Joining us now is Rob Weil, economy and tech reporter with the Miami Herald. Rob, a lot of management changes can be seen as a sign that something's wrong. Are people riding these trains?
It's a little unclear, and Brightline would say it's still too early, that they're still getting the word out. People in South Florida are sort of late adopters. They're very attached to their cars. It hasn't been any kind of overnight success. People are riding it, but it's not where they want it to be at this point.
Well, you say people are attached to their cars. They also spend a lot of time in traffic, and this new train can get you from Fort Lauderdale to Miami in, what, about 30 minutes? How long does it take to drive that distance in traffic?
It takes about an hour and a half on the worst day. There's unquestionably a need to alleviate the congestion that we have down here, but I think for most people, the idea of riding a train is not something that they grew up with. When they imagine alleviating traffic, there's some magical solution where there's just more roads and fewer cars somehow. So there's a disconnect between the problem that everyone is aware of and the solution that's being proposed.
So with new management there at Brightline, is it expected that they're going to be able to change those behaviors in South Florida and get people interested in riding this train, which, by the way, I guess you can get a ticket for as little as $10.
The big grand vision is to get people going from Miami to Orlando. And that's where the sticking point is now. They've been able to get up and running these lines from Miami now to West Palm Beach through Fort Lauderdale. But I think the magic stroke will be if people realize that they can take this to Orlando, to Disney World, and not have to get in their cars. But what we are seeing, and with the CFO change, they are trying to find ways to raise money, and they're going after these bonds that are tax-free that are made available by Congress. But there's a dispute between different factions north of West Palm Beach, where this next leg is supposed to be built, that doesn't want this rail in their backyard. They think it's going to be dangerous. So they have opposed it. That's the sticking point right now.
There have also been 7 fatalities involving Brightline trains. At least 4 appear to have been suicides. Has that hurt the image of Brightline?
Unquestionably. And again, I think it reflects on just a lack of familiarity. There's no train culture, let alone public transportation culture, that's very strong in South Florida. You know, I think there's also just a foreign element to this that people aren't quite sure, you know, how to interact with high-speed rail zones that have come up now in their backyard. So, yes, it has unquestionably hurt the image.
So make your guess, Rob. A year from now, if we were to talk about this, do you think that Brightline will still be struggling?
I think ridership will slowly increase, but there's no way to know. They have to get the money raised to finance this last leg again. It's sort of Disney magic, if you will. If the Orlando leg can get built and there's a viral effect of saying, hey, I just took this train for $30 to zip up to Orlando, to the Magic Kingdom, that will really get people going.
That's Rob Weil, who is economy and tech reporter at the Miami Herald, talking with us about the private high-speed rail service called Brightline in South Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
In a first for a state, Maine voters will rank their choices in order of preference instead of picking just one in their primary tomorrow. Steve Missler is Maine Public Radio's chief political correspondent and State House bureau chief. Steve, you've been trying to explain this to people in and outside your state, so let's just back up. This initiative to do this was approved by voters in 2016. So what was the thinking behind it?
The idea of ranked choice voting had been kicked around in the legislature for several years prior to it becoming a ballot initiative in 2016. But the real impetus for this becoming a law was Governor Paula Page, a Republican who won by a narrow plurality in 2010 and was reelected in 2014 with more votes than he originally won. But there was still fears among the center-left electorate or activists therein. He was benefiting from a split.
What happened was there was a 5-way contest, and he won by less than 2 percentage points after a Democrat and an independent candidate split that center-left vote. And he, we should remind people, is a very controversial, very outspoken governor. So they put this system on the ballot, and the voters voted for it.
They did, and many of the voters who supported it for the very reasons that it was put on the ballot. You know, the other issue is that independents, there's an activist group that support independent candidates who believe that this system will benefit them going forward. So it was sort of a meeting of the minds, if you will.
Well, Republicans have fought this from the very beginning, including cutting the funds that would help implement this system of voting.
Yeah, they really see this as an existential threat, that it's going to prevent real conservative candidates from ever winning statewide election ever again. And what they did is they blocked funding to implement the system for the June primary, which is tomorrow.
Well, so how's it going, given that, for instance, the governor also said that no police could escort the ballot, so they had to hire a private courier system? How's it going?
Well, we will see. I mean, the Secretary of State Matt Dunlap seems to think it's going okay, and the town clerks that we've spoken with seem to think it's going okay. But the real test is really tomorrow. And it's going to be very interesting to see how it all pans out. We've been able to speak with some voters who have used it early because of Maine's early absentee law. And so we've got a taste of what their experience has been, including one voter, and his name is Stephen Ferrand. He's a registered Democrat who found that he likes ranked choice voting, but wasn't quite sure how it was going to work.
Well, let's listen to a little. Here he's talking about his number one ranked candidate, but there are rounds of counting, so his candidate could be eliminated.
When will that person fall out of the count and then my number two will kick in? How do I deal with that? So it's very complicated.
How is it supposed to work? You pick your first, second, third, fourth choices?
That's right. So instead of just picking one candidate, you're basically going down through the list of candidates. And if in this case, let's use the Democratic gubernatorial primary as an example, there are seven candidates. So there are seven candidates that appear on the ballot with rankings for each one. And it's kind of like a grid. And each, you know, the voter goes and they can pick as many or as few candidates as they want. And so they can rank all seven, or they can rank just one or three or four. It doesn't matter. That's really how it's supposed to work. And then, you know, if one of the candidates obtains a majority after the first count, then they win. That's it. There's no ranking tabulation or any of that. But if they don't, that's when the ranking tabulation process begins. It's kind of difficult to explain, but basically the candidate who receives the fewest first place votes is eliminated after the first tabulation. But their votes, their other rankings, then are assigned to the remainder of the candidates. And that process just continues on and on and on until one of the candidates obtains a majority.
Boy, they're not even going to find out tomorrow.
No, they are not. No. We're expecting at least a six-day delay in determining who wins. And that's a function largely of the fact that that the primaries are a pretty crowded field.
Well, there are cities that are already doing ranked voting. But as we said, this is the first state to do it. And the voters are also voting tomorrow on whether to continue it?
That's correct. So there's a separate ballot question that will determine whether, A, this method of voting will be used in November for congressional contests only. If voters defeat that, then it won't be used in November, and it may never be used again. Because that could give the opponents of this law probably enough cover to allow it to be repealed.
Well, and we should say that Republicans helped pass a law to repeal ranked choice voting. And this question that's on the ballot tomorrow about keeping it is from the system supporters. They put a veto of the Republican repeal on the ballot. So
that's correct.
you need a whiteboard when you go vote tomorrow in Maine. Well, we wish maniacs, as some of them call themselves, all the best in tomorrow's primary. That's Steve Missler, Maine Public Radio's chief political correspondent, State House Bureau Chief. He will be busy tomorrow. Steve, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
And we want to just take a few minutes now to say goodbye to a jazz great. New York's Village Vanguard probably comes closer than any other club to embodying the spirit of jazz. And for nearly 25 years, the guardian of that spirit was the Vanguard's formidable impresaria, Lorraine Gordon. A jazz champion since she was a teen, a female pioneer. She died Saturday from complications related to a stroke. She was 95. Lara Pellegrinelli brings us this appreciation.
She was never hard to find.
Village Vanguard.
On most evenings, Lorraine Gordon shuttled between two points, a table to the left of the stage at the Village Vanguard and the club's so-called kitchen. That's where she'd hang out with musicians, do the club's books, and take reservations by hand on a legal pad behind an ancient desk.
How many people do you have?
Once called the Camelot of Jazz Rooms, the Village Vanguard hosted Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans, to name just a few of the legendary talents who've graced its tiny stage. Lorraine Gordon's late husband, Max, opened the club on the site of a former speakeasy in 1935. She inherited her role as its honored caretaker when he passed away 54 years later. She's become almost as much a fixture as the club itself.
She's a real New York character.
Bruce Lundvall is the former president and CEO of Blue Note Records.
She's tough, but she's charming and she's wonderful and she's smart as a whip. And of course, she runs the greatest jazz club in the world, period.
Lorraine Gordon's affinity for jazz arguably ran as deep, if not deeper, than her late husband's, as she said in a 2010 interview.
Well, I love jazz from the day I was practically a toddler. I don't know why, but I don't question it. I'm glad I do.
As a teenager growing up in New Jersey, she was a member of the Newark Hot Club and an enthusiastic collector of jazz records. Some of the best ones, she thought, were on the Blue Note label. That was a happy coincidence because Gordon's first love, after jazz, was Alfred Lion, Blue Note's co-founder. They married in 1943. As a war bride, and for the 7 years their union lasted, she helped with the label's operations, doing the books, promoting artists, and helping to select the takes used in the finished albums. Sometimes she took a special interest in a musician, like pianist Thelonious Monk.
Nobody understood Monk but me.
She convinced Max Gordon, who was then just a business acquaintance, to book the pianist at the Vanguard.
He came here and played, and there was nobody here to listen except Monk and the group on the stage and me and a couple of my friends.
Luckily, Max didn't hold it against her much. After they were married, Gordon traded work for motherhood, although she was also a committed political activist for women's strike for peace, protesting nuclear testing, and against the Vietnam War. In 1965, she made a daring visit to North Vietnam, illegal during wartime. Lorraine Gordon was anything but an unwitting spouse impressed into service. She reopened the Village Vanguard the night after Max died, continuing his legacy and letting her ears be her guide.
It has to do with your perception of what you like, how you see the music, and people will agree with you or not. I don't care if they don't agree. It's what I like. Eventually they agree, though. I don't have a lot of bad marks against me. One or two, maybe.
Lorraine Gordon published a memoir titled Alive at the Village Vanguard, and in 2013, she was recognized as a jazz master by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the only time the honor has been given to a club owner. For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in New York.
When you see them, you realize why I love my sweet Lorraine.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Now when it's raining, I don't miss the sun.
The stock market is near record highs. The unemployment rate is 3.8%. Wages are up. The economy has been growing for more than 9 years. What could go wrong? Well, maybe a bubble in corporate debt, according to a column in the Washington Post by Steve Perlstein, a business and economics columnist there and a professor of public affairs at George Mason University. Steve Perlstein, welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be with you.
So if you look at the numbers right now, it looks like the economy is doing pretty well. The unemployment rate is very low, for one thing. You're concerned that we may be facing another recession. Why?
Well, there's a lot about the fundamentals of our economy that are quite strong. But it's probably the fundamentals are not as strong as the economy looks now. And that's because it's been sort of goosed up artificially by a lot of cheap credit. This time, the cheap credit is not primarily consumer credit, although consumer credit is, by the way, at record levels. But it's corporate credit. Corporate borrowing has just soared in the last 5 or 6 years. It's been cheap and it's been plentiful and they've gorged on it. The thing is that when one sector of the economy, it could be the consumer sector, it could be the business sector, takes on a lot of credit and then they spend that money, it artificially creates the amount of activity, goods and services, the amount of investment and purchasing. And that creates jobs and that creates income and all that's good, but it's not sustainable because a lot of the increase in that activity has been fueled by debt that we already have too much of it now, and we can't keep adding to it.
Well, and you also say that corporations are using some of that cheap money for stock buybacks, not to go and invest and create jobs.
Exactly. And the level of buybacks, Jeremy, is one will likely be $1.2 trillion. By any standard, that is a huge amount of money. Even in a $19 trillion economy, $1.2 trillion is a lot. And at least a third of it is borrowed. And what it means is that there's a hollowing out going on. We're borrowing money in order to buy back our own stock. We're substituting debt for equity. And we're not putting the money back into those companies. Now, one could argue the people get the money because the stock is being bought back mm-hmm. and those people aren't putting it under their mattress. They're reinvesting it somewhere else. Well, maybe or maybe not. Or maybe it's just being used to fuel a bubble in financial assets. That's stocks, that's bonds, that's real estate, that's racehorses, mm-hmm. That's houses in the Hamptons, that sort of thing.
You also point out that part of this is because of the huge tax cut, both for corporations and individuals, that just went into effect this year.
Right. And that was had a one-time effect for international corporations. Suddenly, a whole lot of cash was trapped overseas could be brought home. Profits that had made overseas was brought home at a favorable tax rate. And so they had a lot of cash that they didn't know what to do with. That's another thing that has propelled the stock buybacks. But even notwithstanding that, a good deal of them, at least a third, are being paid for by borrowed money.
What are regulators to do? Because you're not dealing here necessarily with banks where they have a little more control, or even with consumers where they can have a little more control over mortgages that are handed out, et cetera. How do regulators deal with corporations taking on too much debt?
Number one, the purpose of stock buybacks is to essentially to raise the stock price. The reason they buy back the stock is they increase the demand for the stock. The company increases the demand for its own stock. At the same time, it's reducing the supply. And, you know, simple economics would tell you that that raises the price. The SEC has used to prevent that. They used to say, look, that's stock manipulation. We're not going to allow you to do it. And this is now decades ago. They said, okay, it's okay. That's one way. The other way is that, I don't know, in the article, there's a reference to things called CLOs, which is collateralized debt obligation. And banks are making those original loans before they package them and sell them and slice them and dice them and sell them off to investors the same way they did in the last boom with mortgage-backed securities. All of this is very familiar. All you have to do is take mortgage out and put corporate in, and you're basically seeing the same thing that we saw back in the 2006-2007 era.
So keeping in mind that the old saying is that economists have predicted 9 out of the last 5 recessions,
right.
What do you think would set this one off?
The answer is when one doesn't know. All one knows in a bubble is, first of all, they always last longer than you think they can. Mm. And number two, they always unwind faster than you think they will. This is known as Dornbush's law, named after MIT economist Rudy Dornbush. But these things, we know that when they get this big, when they get to be record levels, and when the growth is as strong as every year after year as it is now, that's how you sort of recognize a bubble.
That's Steve Perlstein, business and economics columnist at The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
You say that so lightly as if we haven't just heard about a bubble.
It's coming.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.